This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. You're listening to Place to Be Nation's Extra Point with knowledgeable analysts and exclusive special guests. It's your look at the world of sports through the eyes of Place to Be Nation. And now, your hosts, Scott Criscolo and Dr. G. George Ribolino.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to episode number 9 of your home for everything sports, Place to Be Nation's Extra Point. I'm your co-host, Scott Criscolo. It has been a busy week. We have a lot to talk about. Of course, little patriotism in the air, and my compadre always enjoys that because he is probably the most patriotic human being I know. As we are speaking, the United States taking on Portugal in the World Cup. I guess it would be the, what do they call this, the round robin round. And they're trying to get to the knockout round. Sounds like a TNA thing. We got to get to the knockout round. The World Cup by Dixie Carter. And there'll be 15 people at each game. All right, enough of my bloviating. Let's bring in my compadre who's... Internet on our last program was working about as well as the Mets training staff, and it's working much better this evening. He is I was going to try and start like a new thing where I pick different TV doctors. He is the who's George Clooney on ER? Nobody cares. You don't like that show anyway. The doctor, Dr. G, George Ribolino. I'm trying to give you like a cool nickname or something.
You call me like Trapper John, M.D. or something like that.
I didn't want to go like 280s, but Doctor, it's good to have you back. It's good to have you.
Well, we don't have anybody that listens that was from the 80s.
Well, that's true. That is true.
Let's get serious.
I mean, come on.
I'm glad to be back. It was a very frustrating a few weeks ago.
It was very frustrating.
But we're back. We're back in action here. We got a lot going on. A lot of things going on in sports. I mean, the World Cup, it's so funny because most people don't even watch soccer. But because of the, the patriotism of it, I guess everybody really gets behind it. And even I'll pay attention to it. I'm not a big soccer fan, but it's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. You obviously want to see the United States. I go United States first. I go Italy second. Italy got upset.
Like Costa Rica, a country that's smaller than my apartment.
So that was kind of disappointing, and the U.S. is not looking too great either right now. So I don't know. Hopefully, one of those two teams will something.
Yep.
No. It's exciting time for that. Obviously the baseball pennant races are heating up.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting to the NBA draft. We're getting now, Melo's opting out, so that's going to be the big talk in the NBA.
Yes. Well, let's set up the rest of your listening pleasures, Place to Be Nation. Coming up after the break, we're actually going to kind of have a sequel to our last show because both these guys are awesome. Andrew Reich will join us in segment two. It is NBA draft coming up, as Dr. G said, and we'll talk a little bit about that. He's got a great column coming up this week on PlaceToBeNation.com pertaining to the NBA draft. And we'll talk about that with him. We'll also talk about Melo, as the doctor mentioned, sayonara, Big Apple. Melo's like, I ain't dealing with this crap anymore. And I don't think he's going to go to the Heat, though, but we'll talk to Reish about that in the next segment. Then, normally he's on every other main event show, but one of the saddest things that happened, of course, this week, Dr. G, was the death of Hall of Famer Tony Gwynn earlier this week from cancer, 54 years old. That sucks.
Yeah, one of the good guys in baseball.
Absolutely,
it's a very, very, very sad. It was a very sad day in baseball, and losing one of its good ones. And we'll definitely love to talk to Joel about that.
Yes.
Because what a career this guy had.
Yes, and Joel, of course, is Place to Be Nation's baseball analyst. Joel Barnhart will join us in segment three to talk about Tony Gwynn and the goings on in Major League Baseball as we get into summer, as we are recording yesterday, Dr. G, Saturday was the first day of summer, which means we're going to get a lot of rain and humidity. because here in the Northeast, we don't get anything easy. So after a snowy, crappy winter, we're going to get a soggy, crappy summer, hopefully.
Well,
not.
During the week, usually it's kind of, crappy out. But the weekends, at least the last two or three weekends, have been gorgeous. You know, talking about 75, 80 degrees, no humidity. It's beautiful now. I got the windows open now, looking outside, the sun's shining. It's just I'm not complaining right now, but we'll see. You know, we still got a few months left
for it to go all down the shitter. So
exactly, but I tell you, it's just again, I love this time of the year with sports. I mean, I know that we get ready for the football training camp soon. We have baseball hitting its stride. We have the NBA draft. It's just an exciting time, and today, obviously I was watching, it was Old Timers Day for the Yankees today.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
And I just love watching that. I mean, it's just so fun seeing the different generations of players. And, obviously as a Yankee fan, it's interesting to see how the fans react to those 90s teams, that dynasty now. This is where everybody's main focus is. Obviously Yogi and Whitey and those guys will always get their big ovations, but it's nice to see some of the guys from those 90s teams. And even the most recent 2009 team, now we had Hideki Matsui and Johnny Damon, and the nice applause that those guys got. So I'm really excited. I get juiced up this time of the year.
Yeah, and you see those guys and a lot of other teams. I mean, they don't do it at the level the Yankees do, sadly. The Mets don't even get me started on their front office. They don't even the greatest team in the history of the franchise, the 1986 team, and they don't even want to acknowledge they exist. So don't even get me started on sports history, because a lot of people think and there's a dichotomy there, because a lot of people think the Yankees over exemplify their numbers and retire everybody, and then others think the Mets are stingy and they only have technically five numbers retired, because everybody retired Jackie Robinson except the Yankees, who retired Mariano Rivera's. But there's a Jackie Robinson plaque, right, in Monument Park?
Yep. Yeah, they made a nice gigantic plaque for him in Monument Park. But listen, every team does it differently. I don't try to criticize one way or another. Everybody does it differently. There's some people that don't think, like Goose Gossage and Tino Martinez and Paul O'Neill should get plaques in Monument Park. That's their business. I think it's great to honor those guys who did something for your team. They may not, Gossage is a Hall of Fame, but O'Neill and Martinez may not have been Hall of Famers, but they were great Yankees and they were key components to the teams that one, and you got to understand, it's very, very hard, and I think everybody can understand this, very, very hard to win a championship this day. No matter how much money you spend on your teams, you got to go through, many rounds of playoffs now for all sports. When you win a championship, it's harder to have. You're not going to see those five in a row championships like the Yankees did, in baseball today.
I mean, a lot of people thought that the Giants were going to, after 2010, when they beat Texas, because they had such a good great pitching staff, and that's what wins you championships. Now, we go back to the 90s, and the Atlanta Braves, Chad, had a bitchin' rotation: Greg Maddux, Tom Glavine, John Smoltz, Denny Nagel, Kevin Millwood. At that stretch, and they won one ring, because sometimes,
It just proves to you how hard it is to win. And it's just amazing that the right players get hot at the right time, or some players are just clutch playoff players. They may be there are some players that are average during the year, but they get to those playoffs and they turn it on. Or you just get some of those clutch players, like I've seen over my time, and like a Derek Jeter or even a David Ortiz. Those guys, they just like step it up. Bernie Williams, they just step it up when it comes to that playoff time.
Right.
And it's just amazing. And the thing is that sometimes, obviously with Carlos Beltran being on the Yankees this year, and I'm trying not to be totally Yankee laden heavy here. I'm just trying to make a point, is that as a Mets fan, he had some big moments for the Mets fans, but the moment everybody remembers is him looking, with Wainwright in 2006, looking at strike three. And that's how everybody remembers him as a Mets fan. But you know, you got to understand, and maybe just because of, you know, the Mets didn't win anything else after that, and that's probably it. I guess if the Mets had won a championship, you probably wouldn't even talk about it anymore, is that you're not going to come through every single time. Even Mariano Rivera didn't come through every single time. He's blown, you know, a few here and there. But for the most part, you know, his body of work is so great that he's remembered for that. But I guess if it had the Yankees not won some of those championships, he may not be thought of as fondly like Carlos Beltran is. So the point is that it's so hard to win a championship in sports today, mm-hmm. that there's just a certain makeup in players that it's amazing. And there are certain players that could just perform under that pressure. And that's why I say if you do win, you know, 2 and 3 years, 3 and 5 years championships, those you got to consider those dynasties today, because mm-hmm. it's very, very hard when you go through these rounds of playoffs to maintain and do 3 or 4 or 5 in a row. It's really not an easy thing to do.
Right.
I mean, look at the Miami Heat, for instance. I mean, look at, you know, you have the big three and you think, wow, those guys are just going to mow them down. Just put them in the playoffs. Just give them the ring. And look at the Spurs. I mean, you know, you have to put Greg Popovich up there as one of the greatest coaches. And what he's done with that San Antonio Spurs team over the last 10 to 15 years. You know, you got to consider one of, you know, that San Antonio Spurs team. I mean, there's been some different, you know, different versions of the team. But for the most part, they've had the main guys. You got to consider that to be somewhat of a dynasty. Mm. You know, you've seen it with your Lakers. You've seen it with, you know, the Heat. We're going to get there. I mean, had the Heat won again this year, you know, you would have to call them, you know, a dynasty for these last 5 years or so. Mm-hmm. So it just proves to you just how hard it is to win a championship. And as great of a player as LeBron James is, you still have to have the other guys step it up around you.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And I mean, you know, it goes over all sports. I mean, you talk about the 90s, you talk about the possibility that had Michael Jordan not taken that forced sabbatical in the mid 90s. And we all know it was forced. David Stern pretty much told him because of all the gambling issues he had that could have led to legal problems that he went and batted 137 for the Birmingham Barons or whatever the hell he did, that there was probably no doubt that the Bulls would have won 8 in a row from 1991 to 1998. The Rockets wouldn't have. I think the Rockets would have given the Bulls two hell of a series in 94 and 95.
Right.
But
But again, you know, what if, you know, everybody, I'm sure when this series started with the Heat, even though people are starting to see the flaws in the Heat, mm-hmm. Especially their bench, everybody would have said, why even bother, you know, the Heat are, you know, going to win this one again. You have to play the games. So, yeah, you could say because that Bulls team was so great that they could have, but you still have to go out there and play it and do it and make it through all those rounds of playoffs, because you get somebody hot at the right time. We see it in. You know, we see this stuff in hockey. Look at the Kings, who were the Stanley Cup champions.
Right.
The first two series went 7 games. I mean, you know, they kind of just, you know, played through the year. Nothing great, nothing spectacular. But they got to the playoffs and they got hot. They have a lot of big guys. Quick, you know, had some good series, especially in the finals. And here you are, they're Stanley Cup champions.
Yep, and we'll talk about that. Now, we were supposed to have Todd Gessling on tonight. Todd sadly had to postpone. We'll have him on our next show to talk about both the Stanley Cup playoffs and the new schedules that have come out. And, of course, the LA Kings are your world champions after dispatching of the New York Rangers in 5 games. Competitive games. I mean, Quick threw the one shutout in Game 3 at the Garden, but the other 4 games were all very competitive. And, of course, the double overtime win for the Kings at home in Game 5. He also was going to talk World Cup, but I kind of want to talk about World Cup with him when we're done. Now, you want some great World Cup analysis. Our counterparts at the Sports Lounge had a nice segment. Jeff Machado talked about in-depth World Cup stuff. I want to ask you, though, Doctor, I want to go a different route about the viewing, the fan of the World Cup. Now, when I was a kid, I didn't really know much about it. I don't remember soccer much on TV in the 1980s. I think the first one that I remember was probably 1986, I suppose. I think that was the one. I think it was before 2006. I think that was the last one
I would say
that Italy won.
Hot in the last 10 years, wouldn't you say? I mean,
yeah.
I don't totally remember it now. I played soccer for like 3 years when I was younger. And I remember when I was living down in Florida, we had the Fort Lauderdale Strikers, mm-hmm. Pro soccer team. And they played at Lockhart Stadium, which was right near Fort Lauderdale Stadium where the Yankees had spring training. And I went to a few games, and I'll tell you, there were some really good crowds there. But eventually, you know, it tailed off and the team, you know, went out of business. But I remember soccer had that little peak of, you know, everybody was playing. Because I remember, you know, in the soccer league, I mean, the teams were just packed. Everybody, the kids were into it for that period of time. Then it kind of waned a little bit. But I would say, like, in the last 10 years, it's gotten hot again. Mm. And you know, it's exciting because people get behind their countries. Mm-hmm. And in this country, we have people from so many, you know, where we are the melting pot, so we have people from so many different countries that it makes it exciting. Again, you know, everything, they put everything like a pool, so, I mean, there's a gambling aspect to it, which yep. is, you know, and I'll go on, you know, maybe we'll offer another topic for another day of why the Super Bowl and why the NCAA tournament is so popular because of gambling. I mean, basically that's what it is. I mean, most people, and now with the Super Bowl has become an event, and then with the commercials, but you know, there's a big gambling aspect to it.
Right. Yes, there definitely is. Well, look at 1994. You know, look at 1994 when we, which is really the first World Cup that this country really embraced because we hosted it. Now remember, right. Now 1990 it was in Italy and Germany won that year, but 1994 of course we hosted it. And Brazil won. That was the infamous final where Roberto Baggio kicked the penalty kick over the shootout kick over the net, and I had to buy an entire round of Guinness for a bunch of Irish guys at a bar in Newport, Rhode Island. But that was the first big one. Now, do you remember the U.S. played Colombia in the I don't know which round it was. Was it the round robin or was it the post? I don't know which one it was, but I don't know which round it was. But and Colombia, it was in the round robin. Now I'm looking at it. It was Andres Escobar. He kicked a ball into his own net. If you remember this very vividly, if you guys remember,
oh yeah, I remember.
He kicked the ball. We U.S. was playing Colombia in the round robin. And he was trying to block a pass, and instead the ball kicked straight ahead and went past his own goalie for a goal. We won the game, the U.S., and then 10 days later, the guy was shot outside a bar in Colombia. Yeah, why do you think he was shot? Just because the country was pissed off? No. Somebody, obviously some group lost some serious scratch on that game.
Yeah,
so.
No, it's there's definitely that part of it. And I'll tell you, though, people don't realize, and, you know, we know some people from other countries, soccer is, or what they call football, is very, very big overseas. I mean, some of the highest paid athletes in the world are not American athletes. They are, you know, they're soccer, you know, stars. So it's a very, very big sport. They take it like we take our American football seriously every week. That's how soccer is in other countries.
Right.
I feel like it's getting a little bit more popular here, but I wouldn't say it's I don't know if it'll ever reach the level of, you know, baseball, mm-hmm. football, even, you know, NBA and you know, maybe to an NHL level. I don't know.
Yeah. But I remember definitely that it was first really embraced by our country in 1994 when we hosted it. And now there's rumors,
right.
And now there's rumors that we may be hosting it in 2022 because of alleged corruption, which is no shock there, between the World Cup committee and, I guess, is it Qatar or Abu Dhabi or one of those? I think it's Qatar or Qatar, depending on how you say it, involving corruption and briberies and other sordid dealings that the U.S. may be called on as a backup to host the 2022 World Cup.
Well, I'll tell you this, Scott. There's a lot of money involved in this now. The TV contracts where they were so small even 10 years ago, now they're in the billions now worldwide. So it's become a very, very big money maker, and that's why you'll see it come back. And again, you have so many countries around the world that are so into this. I mean, you know, when I'm even in the city and stuff like that, people have it on in different places. Even one of the food trucks the other day had like a screen. Yeah. And they were the game. And I came in contact with this one guy, you know, you got to love New Yorkers, you know, and everybody, he's just starting talking. He goes, and I forget what country he said he was from, and he's like, I don't care, I'm United States. And they all laugh at me, but I want to see the United States win. You know, he's very happy to be here, and he's like,
oh, yeah, of course.
United States first. That's what it is first. And then I forget where he said he was from. He said, then that they're second. But this is the team. We're going to do it. I feel it this year. And he's like going on and on and on. It was hysterical. But it's neat to see the passion that some people have. Even at my job, they passed around like, for marketing, they just passed around like the whole the brackets for us. Not for gambling or anything like that. It wasn't even for that. It was just to give so you could keep track of it. And then one of the TVs we have in one of the areas of the place that they'll have the games on, just for people to track it and have fun with it. And, you know, just because, it adds some camaraderie. So it's, you know what? I'm not a big soccer fan, but it caught my attention. I watched the end of the Italy-Costa Rica game the other day. So, I mean, you know, if we could get somebody that's really not into it to watch it, that's why it's I think it's becoming more popular.
And you know what? Saturday, the Germany-Ghana game was bonkers. I think somebody led 1-0. Germany led 1-0. Then Ghana scored two straight goals to take a 2-1 lead. Then Germany tied it with like 4 minutes left. They ended up playing it with 2-2. So, I mean, there has been some exciting moments so far in this World Cup, if you've been paying attention. Now, today, Portugal's leading the U.S. 1-0 about 37 minutes in, so I guess what, into the first half. Earlier today, Belgium beat Russia 1-0, and Algeria beat South Korea 4-2, which is like, 4-2 is like 108-105 in NBA terms. Six goals in a game is crazy. Starting on Monday, now by the time you hear this on Tuesday, this will have already happened, but now they're going to start doing quadruple headers and two games being going on at the same time. They got to kind of catch this thing up. Australia, Spain's out of it. And here's another thing. There's a lot of frustration with a lot of these countries, both in South America and in Europe, because I was talking to somebody today who's Chilean, who's paying attention to his team. In fact, Chile played the Netherlands on Monday. Who says that a lot of these countries are very stubborn when it comes to advancing younger players, and they get old quick. And I think that's what happened to Italy in 2010 after winning the World Cup in 2006. They got very old and broke down and didn't make the knockout round. And I think the same thing happened to Spain this year. I mean, they're done. Doesn't matter. They could win 50-0 against Australia on Monday. And again, by the time you hear this, they would have played. They're out. So we are going to officially have a new World Cup champion this year. Which is crazy.
Which adds some excitement.
Yes, it actually does. A lot of people think France is a favorite. They've looked very good. Although a lot of experts have told me that have been really paying attention that France is in a pretty weak bracket. Germany is a heavy favorite. They're very good. Italy is okay. I mean, they're not as good as they were in past years, but they're not bad. The U.S., it's always just wait and see. You know, maybe they'll go on a run. Maybe they'll get lucky. They're obviously, it'll – who knows? I seriously doubt the U.S. will ever be the most talented team in a World Cup. I don't think that's ever going to happen. If it does, then that's great for
– We have to go get some ringers.
Yeah, we have to get guys – we have to get guys that Bella Caroli did when he defected from Romania and coached our women's gymnasts to gold medals after he coached Nadia Comăneci in the 76 Olympics to gold. So we will have Todd Gessling on in a couple weeks to give us kind of a World Cup wrap-up and talk about the World Cup in general. He's kind of one of our big experts. But again, listen to the Sports Lounge this week as well. Jeff Machado did a nice segment with those guys about the World Cup. So we'll talk more about this with Andrew Riche in our next segment, but it is official. Melo is leaving the Knicks.
No, he's not. It's not a big.
Well, he's opting out of his contract, which means he wants to test the waters. If you wanted to stay a Knick, though, wouldn't you just not? Why would you try and fleece the Knicks? Are you going to make the Knicks earn?
I have to be honest with you. I don't see Phil Jackson really doing anything that's enticing anybody to want to stay. I mean,
yeah.
He's a little hand – you know, his hands are tied a little bit based on the contracts that they have and where they are with the cap. But,
right.
You know, I don't know. I mean, but I can't see them investing all in one player and then not being able to do something. So it's going to be interesting to see, because if Melo leaves the Knicks, where does Phil go next? I hear the Rockets are want to make a big play for Melo.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to go to. I don't think he's going to go to the Heat. I mean, the Heat, I think, have other issues right now they've got to deal with, and we'll talk more about it with Reish in the next segment. You know, they've got their own issues. I mean, obviously, the San Antonio Spurs are your world champions. They beat the Heat in five games. And it, except for the, and they probably should have swept them, because the Heat, the Spurs let Game Two get away. Otherwise, they should have swept the Heat, to be honest with you. So, is this it for the Spurs? See, I was telling my brother, who's a who, as you, for those that have listened to all of the shows here on Place to Be Nation, is a big Spurs fan. He thought that, and I said the same thing, that pretty much Popovich.
Your family confuses me. I thought he was a Knicks fan.
He used to be a Knicks fan. Then he spent 1 year in San Antonio, and he fell in love with the Spurs because he gave up on the Knicks in the early 2000s. My brothers go with the wind. You know, my brother Jeff, love him to death. And I love my brothers, but they're kind of knuckleheads. You know, my brother Jeff lived down in Georgia for 4 years, 5 years, in the early 90s, and suddenly he loved the Braves. So I said to him, I said 2 years later, I said, oh, so you're rooting for the Braves in the 96 World Series?
Exactly.
He didn't really like that question very much.
Well,
that's the truth.
Your team.
He loved the By the way, on a side note, I still can't believe this, and I've talked with Chad Campbell about this many times. Can you believe that after only what 17 years, the Atlanta Braves are getting a new ballpark? Turner Field's only 17 years old.
Yeah, it's kind of strange.
And they're building a ballpark in the big boss man's neck of the woods, Dr. G, Cobb County. I think they should have a boss man statue in front.
Well, what did he say? What did Chad
he
say?
He says a lot of it has to do with the fact that even though it's in Atlanta, Turner Field, there's nothing around it. It's very because remember, it was part of the Olympic Park when Atlanta had the Olympics in 96. So all the stuff around it's pretty much empty. So there was nothing holding anything there after the Olympics ended. So he said that there's really not much to do around Turner Field. Now, they want to have this huge kind of Metroplex deal in Cobb County with restaurants and shopping, and you know, make it like a big, you know, kind of like the Riverwalk at San Antonio where the Alamo Dome is, something like that, which makes sense from a tourism and a economic perspective. But I mean, 17 years in Turner. My brother went to Turner Field. He went to the 2000 All-Star Game, which your boy Jeter was the MVP of. Right? I think the 2000 All-Star Game was in Atlanta. Was it 2000? Yeah, I think it was 2000. And he said the ballpark's beautiful, but apparently not a lot of suites. That's what it comes down to. No one gives a shit about the seats anymore.
That's what it's all about.
No one cares about the seats. It's about the big suites. And there wasn't enough because the building wasn't built for that kind of for that kind of situation. It was built for the it was built for the Olympics. So what do you need suites for the Olympics for? What, are you gonna have luxury suites to watch the javelin? Or the 4x100 meter relay, although Michael Johnson with his gold cleats in 96, his gold spikes, I should say. So, isn't that neat? And then Atlanta is also getting a new football stadium. The Georgia Dome's barely 20 years old. And the Falcons are getting a new building. Here's a city that everybody rips as being so apathetic to their sports teams. And here they are going to get two brand new buildings for their two main teams. In the last 15 years, you've had the Phillips Arena was built, so you had a new building for the Hawks. You're going to have a new building for the Braves, and a new building for the Falcons over the next few years. Meanwhile, the Thrashers left and became the Winnipeg Jets.
Now, I would love to ask Chad this. Like, what are they?
We'll get Chad on.
What are they going to do with Turner Field? And
I don't know.
And
keep it, use it for, I don't know, maybe like maybe do like what they did to the old Yankee Stadium.
These facilities cost a lot of money to maintain it. If you're not going to have a full-time tenant in them, it's very hard, you know, to use taxpayer money to keep funding these fields that are not, you know, not bringing any revenue in.
Right, I agree. So, you know what, we'll do that. Maybe we'll get our man Chad Campbell on our next edition of the Extra Point and talk to him about the situation in the city of Atlanta. Because, again, here's a city that everybody gets – I mean, I remember getting so frustrated, Dr. G, during my years as a Met fan in the late 90s when the stupid Braves would always win the NL East and then game one of the division series at Turner Field and the place is half full. I'd kill for – I mean, I'd salivate for playoff games at Citi Field or Shea Stadium at the time. And the Braves, you know, they have nobody showing up. They had nobody showing up for games. So frustrating. So frustrating. You know, they show up for the World Series. Oh, but the Division Series is beneath them. Yeah, whatever. Anyway, why don't we take a breather? And when we come back, we'll be joined by Andrew Reich, our resident hoop junkie. We'll talk about Melo. We'll talk about the Spurs. And most importantly, we will talk about the upcoming NBA draft. Cleveland Cavaliers with the number one pick for the third time in the last 4 years. What are they going to do with it? Like, that's not rigged. This is The Extra Point. He's the doctor. I'm the internist. I don't know. Reich, in a moment. Turn your head now, baby. Just spit me out.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly from Ring of Honor Wrestling. Make sure you check out The Kevin Kelly Show each and every week, placetobenation.com. We'll be talking about wrestling in the past and wrestling today, plus be talking about all kinds of sports and pop culture, whatever's on your mind, too. We'll answer your questions each and every week. The Kevin Kelly Show, right here, placetobenation.com.
Let me know you in the house.
This is the king of old school, Steve Corino, and you've heard all the rumors, and it's true. The Steve Corino Show is here. We talk about wrestling. We talk about baseball, movies, television, anything you want to talk about. New guest every week. That's right. The Steve Corino Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
Hey, this is Bauer from The Bauer Show, sports and more. You can check out The Bauer Show podcast every Wednesday and Friday right here at placetobenation.com.
The Bauer Show.
Chad, do you hate it when commercials one and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on placetobenation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Hey, this is Rob Naylor. Do you still enjoy pro wrestling? Believe it or not, I still do. So you better join myself and Will on the Google Wrestling Podcast exclusively at placetobenation.com.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and... Shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on Place to Be Nation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds terrible. The Titans are wrestling. Oh, brilliant. Sorry. The Titans are wrestling. Oh.
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for a show and breakdown matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover. Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Bob. We watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of Wrestling. You know you want to hear it.
Come, my lady. Come, my lady. You're my butterfly. Sugar, baby. Come, my lady. Come, my lady. You're my butterfly. Sugar, baby. Such a sexy, sexy, pretty little thing. This April bitch, you got me sprung with your tongue ring. And I ain't gonna lie, cause your loving gets me high. So to keep you by my side.
Welcome back. Episode number 9, Place to Be Nation's Extra Point. I am Scott Mascola, along, of course, with the doctor, George Bellino. Coming up later on in the show, Joel Barnhart will join us to talk Tony Gwynn, who sadly passed away earlier this week, and some other tidbits in baseball. Don't forget, hit us up, extra point at placetobenation.com. Ask us anything you want, comments, questions. questions for our analysts, including this guy who I'll intro in a moment, or Joel or anybody else or the doctor or anybody. Whatever you want us to add something to the show, general comments, please. Our door is open. extrapoint@placetobenation.com. This guy's door is always closed because the Larry Johnson jersey is starting to stink. He is the Bengal of the Bayou. I'll be talking to him in about 3 days again on, of course, Place to Be Nation's main event to talk about Money in the Bank and other sordid things about guys whose last name's Cotton Belly. But tonight we're going to get into his wheelhouse because – and if he says as many words as his piece is going to have, he will never speak on this show again. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Andrew Riesch, tell us everything. Tell us, Andrew, how many words your draft piece has.
The last time I fixed it, because I hope I did it, I did my final edit, it was probably around 12,000 words.
Wow.
It's a mamma jamma. It's David Foster Wallace would be proud if he was still around.
Where'd you find the time to write 12,000 words?
I don't think the Hogan-Andre feud was 12,000 words.
No. No, especially in Andre's vocabulary.
That's true,
like,
yes.
It's more like 40 words.
A championship match at WrestleMania. So,
but
anyway.
My Larry Johnson jersey might be stinking, but I just bought the new one with, I think it's going to be Cody Zeller. That's going to be the one I'm going to be rocking.
Cody Zeller, yes. All right. What we're talking about is coming up later this week, probably around maybe, I would say Tuesday by the time this hits air. Riesch will, of course, have his super-duper NBA draft preview. Get you ready for Brooklyn, which is hosting. It's at the Barclays. We'll talk about the draft in a moment, sir, but let's talk about the two main topics in the NBA. Number one, your world champion, San Antonio Spurs, who finished the official five-game bitch slap of the bloated Heat. And let's be honest, it should have been a sweep. I mean, they threw game two in the toilet. They pretty much should have won that game. You said to me, when we were doing main event last or 2 weeks ago, I guess it was, that you watched the most perfect half of basketball. I think it was game four?
Game three. The first half of game three.
You said you never saw a more perfect half of basketball by a team. Why was that?
Because they were able to – they figured out a way – to take everything that Coach Popovich has taught the Spurs how to do on offense for – it might feel like a decade or more in terms of running a lot of different sets and a lot of different styles. And for the first half of Game 3, it seemed like everything they did not only worked, but worked perfectly. Every three-pointer, every dump down to Duncan, every move that Kawhi Leonard made in the paint, everything worked perfectly. And the Miami Heat in that game, I believe, shot over 50%, including from the three-point line. From a field goal percentage standpoint, Miami had a very good game. They did not play poorly. It was that the San Antonio Spurs played so flawlessly in every aspect of the game in terms of offense, along with the rebounding, which they're very good at. And the game became a rout by the time we got to halftime, mm-hmm. despite the fact that the Heat got it close in the second half. Game four was a little different where Miami just couldn't score. And even though the Spurs were kind of going a little slow themselves, by the second half, they were rolling again. And by the time they got back to San Antonio last Sunday, they were up 3-1. The Heat had no momentum, and the series was basically over.
I agree. You have to say that Popovich, probably next to Phil Jackson, has to be the best coach in this generation, coach in this generation. Yeah. What he's done with this team, and especially a team like San Antonio, who's getting up there in years, but I just he's just masterful with this team, and the Spurs. I mean, one of the great teams of all time. I mean, for the most part, the same pieces. You got some different pieces here and there. The earlier years, but I mean, he's done it basically with the same team and this team aging, but just knew how to play everyone right and play to their strengths. And Miami had no answers at all.
Yeah, Popovich has really transcended himself which is weird because his whole persona is not wanting the limelight, not wanting the attention, not wanting people writing about him. And by being so, it's almost like Bill Belichick, by being so deflective of the attention, he's almost garnered more because people want to, it's, you know, people like to know about the more reclusive characters, and Popovich definitely is one by design. And the thing about it with Popovich is this, you know, his mentor when he got into coaching was Larry Brown. And the last time I remember, listen, Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, Manu Ginobili, fantastic players. They're all going to be in the Hall of Fame. They've all earned their keep. They're Olympic champ. Well, outside of Tony Parker, you know, Ginobili has won an Olympic gold medal. But they're all great, great players. Don't get me wrong. Larry Brown coached a team where they had very good players in 2004 when they played a, I guess you could say, to steal another phrase from Scott, a bloated Laker team. And the persona that the Pistons gave off in order to stick together and get past the Lakers, and by doing so crush them, was us. It's about us. It's about the team. It's about togetherness. It's about going with the flow. It's about never getting too high or too low. And I felt like that's what Popovich has been preaching with the Spurs for so long. And they stuck to the game plan. They didn't abandon it because of what happened last year in the finals, where they had the most heartbreaking loss you'll ever see in any kind of walk of life in sports. And they got through it by sticking with the script. And you don't see that a lot in basketball, where great players can do that.
Well, he did this year, and I'll tell you, I was really impressed. And, you know, there's a lot of Heat haters out there, so.
Somewhat unfairly. You know, did they stink in the finals down the stretch? Absolutely. They didn't play their best. They looked old. Rightfully so, because Battier and Allen are both in their late 30s and are about to retire, and Dwayne Wade looked like he was wearing fucking bowling shoes. And
clown shoes.
He was just, I don't know what happened to him. And Chris Bosh has always had trouble guarding Duncan. Every time they play each other, Duncan eats him alive. That's par for the course. LeBron was great, but he had the cramps in the first game, and he didn't make his presence known all the time throughout the game, despite the fact that he had great numbers. The truth is, at the end of the day, the Miami Heat got to the NBA Finals 4 years in a row. That's incredibly hard. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to put too much on Eric Spoelstra, but Casey Jones did the same thing in the 80s, and I don't remember people writing books about how great Casey Jones is.
Yeah.
So, you know, Eric Spoelstra had that chance. He could have been the three-peat guy along with Phil Jackson and Bill Pat Russell Riley. And Red Auerbach and all those guys, and he couldn't do it. So now you take a step back. If you're Miami, you look at your roster. You got all these free agents. Your big three are probably going to opt out. Now what do you do? So this is the first time ever that the Heat are at a position where it's like, okay, now we have to make some – critical decisions here if we want to move forward to try to get the championship back, you know.
Let's talk about you just talked about the Heat, and we'll expound on them in a second. I was saying to my brother, who's a diehard Spurs fan, that I thought that Popovich, Parker, Duncan, and Ginobili all right down the line in that Game 5 presser should have said, thank you, we're done. Thank you, I'm done. Thank you, I'm done. Thank you, I'm done. Should they have done that? What more is for any of those four to accomplish right now? They might as well. I mean, Parker's a little younger than the others, but his legs have locked like Kobe minutes in his career. If you were any of the four of them, would you just walk away now?
Well, in the case of Ginobili, I think he should have considered it, because as poorly as he played in 2013 – this finals was a bit of a redemption act for him, and he played very well in doing so. Popovich is a grinder. He's a guy that just can't get away from the workplace. He's a guy that is just – coaching is in his blood. He, like I said, Larry Brown was his mentor. Larry Brown's the same way. He's over at SMU because he can't get away from the game. And Popovich, to me, is the same kind of way. He's kind of like Jerry Sloan, too. He's just going to keep coaching until he just doesn't want to coach anymore. And I don't think he's given up on it yet. He's mastered this system pretty much to a T, even with younger players and new faces. And I don't think he's ready to give up on it yet. Tony Parker, like you said, is still in his early 30s, maybe mid-30s coming up. And so for him to retire would be kind of asinine. And for Duncan, I think Duncan wants to go out at the same time that Pop does. I think he's more in the vein of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar when he was with Pat Riley, where I think he'll figure out when his time is up.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be maybe in a couple more years once he reaches his 40s. And then I think Duncan will start thinking about it and walk away. And that's where the Spurs are going to really hit their crossroads, which is the same one that the Heat are winding up with. And that's, you know, when Duncan walks away and Ginobili walks away, what do the Spurs do? And I don't think the Duncan wants to be that selfish. You know, I think your brother makes a good point, but I don't, at the end of the day, walking away on your own terms is still selfish. And I don't think he is ready. I don't think those guys are ready to do that yet. When David Robinson did it, he was done. He had nothing left to give. I think Duncan is still at a high level of play. And I don't think walking away and leaving right now is the best thing, because he still has something left to give. And I think he wants to defend the championship. But how great was Kawhi Leonard?
It's his team now, I think.
Oh, my God. Now, they got a great decision. They have a really serious decision to make there, too, because he's at that point where his rookie contract will be up, and you have got to sign him to a max extension. You can't let him walk in free agency. So now, what kind of deal do you – how much cap space do you have to, like, keep guys like Boris Diaw and Patty Mills and Danny Green and guys like that who took less money to go to San Antonio if Kawhi is going to get a really nice meaty deal to be the star of the team going forward? And that'll be really interesting what R.C. Buford tries to put together, and if Kawhi maybe takes less money. I don't know. It's going to be interesting.
Now, the Heat, I'll let the doctor talk about the Heat, because, Reesh, the doctor was a Heat fan during the Ronnie Cycli days, okay, mm-hmm. when they were what? 3-69 or something.
Yeah.
3-79 or something.
That was in the Steve Smith, Glenn Rice days, huh?
Yeah. Yep. Even before that, probably, right?
Oh, and you know what's ironic about that? You know who the first ever coach of the Miami Heat was? It was Ron Rothstein.
Ron Rothstein.
He is still the assistant coach.
Who had
the
worst
Miami
hair in the history of NBA coaches.
Yeah.
It was like a dried out chia pet. Oh my God, his hair. And now I don't think he has any at all.
He's bald now.
Yeah,
he's
I don't
bald.
Think he has any
when,
anymore.
When they had that story about LeBron going to Cleveland for Augustus's ceremony. This is just off topic, but the guy that Riley had as like the goon to make sure that LeBron doesn't get anybody whispering in his ear was Rothstein. He basically followed him, he shadowed him to make sure nobody tried to convince him to, you know, it's like who in Cleveland is going to convince him to come back? I mean, are they going to kidnap his freaking kids? Like,
I mean, yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy.
But
got you.
What are you going to ask me, Scott?
No, what do you think about the Heat? I'll get to Reesh in a second, but now you talk to your sister, who lives in down there, and your right. Obviously your nephew is a LeBron disciple
down on Biscayne Boulevard.
Yeah. Actually, you know what's funny? Reesh. His sister lives in Plantation, which is near where the university, where the U, does their spring practice.
Oh, okay.
So there's a lot of Jim Larrañaga mojo going on down there. But
there's a lot of Frank Haith mojo going on there too, but that's for the wrong reason.
The Frank Haith mojo goes down the stream, and we all know what stream that is. Now you know that area, Jay, and it took a long time, even during the good years when the Heat in the 90s, when they had, you know, Zoe and Tim Thunder Hardaway Man, the UTEP two-step. I don't even think they were that loved as much as this team is, or even the team that won it in 2006 when it was just D Wade.
Well, you got to understand about Miami and sports down there. You know, when I was growing up there, you had a lot of New Yorkers like ourselves. My family, we all moved down there, so the New Yorkers kind of stuck with their teams. Now, I was never a Knicks fan. Matter of fact, my first favorite basketball team was the Sixers because I love Dr. J. It's the only sport I've ever swayed off, you know, went to different teams on would be basketball. I think because basketball, a lot of times people root because of certain players, which is what I did. And then when the Heat came to town in 1988, I decided to, you know, well, now I have a local team, so it was kind of cool. But you had these different generations, and now the generations in Florida, you know, even talking to my sister, it's so different now because now it's like my generation who's growing up there, and they have their kids that are growing up there. They don't have that New York connection or wherever they came from, Ohio or whatever. So now they're building the fan bases of the newer generation,
right,
in Florida now. So you're starting to see that there's and then bringing LeBron James, who is the best basketball player in the world, down there. How could you not be excited about that? But let me tell you something right now. LeBron James leaves the Miami Heat, you're going to see them at the middle of the pack for attendance, and people will go off that bandwagon real quick. It's one of those things, and I don't know, Reese, do you agree with me? I think that basketball is definitely player specific. You know, everybody was a Bulls fan with Michael Jordan. I mean, do you really see anybody with a Bulls jersey around anymore, unless it's a Michael Jordan one? I don't.
Oh yeah, there's absolutely a case of bandwagon fans, and I was definitely one of them because up until about 2002, we did not once I was born, New Orleans was already about 2 years removed from having a franchise when the Jazz moved to Utah. So I didn't have a franchise, in my area for me to even remotely root for until the Hornets came down here in 2002. So before that, yeah, I was a Michael Jordan fan. I loved the Bulls. When Tim Floyd went there and ruined it, I decided to get the fuck out of there,
Everybody else.
And when Phil Jackson, and I love Phil Jackson, so I, through osmosis, I just went on and became a Laker fan because I like Phil Jackson, I like the triangle, and I wanted to see him make Shaq and Kobe succeed the way that he helped Michael and Scottie succeed. So, and then when the Hornets came in, I kind of cheered for the Hornets, and then I would go in and out. The NBA is so different from the NFL because it's not the focus of the NBA is not on the teams as much. It's about the players. And that's why a lot of people are fans, and Justin Rosero will vouch for this, are fans of the Charlotte Hornets because they look cool. They were on the covers of all these magazines like Hoop and on Inside Stuff with their cool jams and all their all their nifty moves and, Tim Hardaway we just talked about. And the thing about the Miami Heat fans, and they do eat a lot of crap, and a lot of times they deserved it because they walked out early in Game 4 when they really shouldn't have. But I remember when you were talking about the Alonzo Mourning, Dan Majerle, Tim Hardaway days, and Jamal Mashburn days. Back then,
I forgot Mash. Good call. Yeah, I forgot about Mash.
Monster Mash. They did a sign and trade with him and Eddie Jones. It was one of the worst decisions they ever made. But off topic there. They had that older arena that they closed down in 99. And I'll say this. I remember when Zoe was there and they were a defensively minded team. That crowd was hot. Like, you would go in there and it was a very hostile environment, especially when they played the Knicks. It wasn't like one of those crowds where they were fair weathered all the time and they didn't really care. The Laker fans are the same way. When the Lakers were really good with Shaq, Kobe, Magic Johnson, that crowd could get on your ass. And it's the problem with the fans is that, like you said, when things get a little bit, when things start to dwindle, they kind of walk away prematurely compared to like Boston fans, Chicago fans, even Philadelphia fans. They don't bail on their team. Whereas Miami, Floridians, they'll probably do that a lot quicker than them. But there are some fan bases there that have really strong cores, but they have a lot of, like we were just talking about, bandwagon jumpers that are ready to jump off.
Yeah, I mean, when I grew up there, like I said, because you had a lot, there weren't like, when I raised my hand in school, it was like you had two Floridians in there and everybody else was either from New York, Ohio, whatever, mostly New York. Now it's obviously different. And like I remember what we couldn't even watch, not that I was a fan, but the Miami Dolphin games would get blacked out because they couldn't sell out the stadium. Now, the Miami Dolphin fans who I knew were fans were passionate. And it's funny, I probably know more Miami Dolphin fans when I came up here to come to school up in the Northeast than I did down in Florida. They're one of those teams that do have fans, around the country, which I think football is just like that in general. But it was really strange. But I'm starting to see. But look at the Marlins for baseball. I mean, they have two world championships.
And the attendance is abysmal, even with the
It's abysmal because, I don't think the fans there trust the ownership.
you know, okay, you're going to, you know, they went and they bought all these guys because the first year of the stadium, they didn't really do much. They just put anybody together, just big names together. They didn't look at the makeup of the team. And then here you go, you know, they didn't do well, and then they just sold everybody off. And, you know, it's like there's no trust there. So, you know, it does make a difference with the ownership. But when it goes to the Heat, I agree with you. I think during that, you know, the Alonzo morning period of time, you know, the Knicks and the Heat had that great rivalry. I think there was some kind of heat there because, you know, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Excellent alliteration.
Pun intended, you could feel the heat in that building when those teams got together because they hated each other.
They did.
And the only time I really felt that with the Heat was when they played the Celtics. I don't even get that when they played the Pacers or the Spurs. Like, now when the Celtics would go to Miami, oh yeah, that fan base would get on them big time. And you could almost feel the Heat, like, feed off of the crowd when they were playing against the Celtics.
You know why? I think that you had, you know, remember Celtics were kind of, yeah, for a while. They weren't really that good of a team. I think you had, again, you have a lot of people from Boston and New York down there, and sometimes, you know, you get those people who are like, you know what, I had enough of those two teams, and they decided to, you know, become Heat fans. So I think that there's like some passion there. We want to beat those guys. We want to beat those teams that we used to root for.
And then there are the fans. Yeah, and then there are the fans that are, if you can't beat them, join them. And they eventually become fans of those dynasties, and they stick around, and they like to say that they were there for the lesser years, but they probably weren't. But it's easy to say that because they're good again, you know?
Well,
because
exactly. It's just that's, again, when they're good. And it's funny because I have a friend that I, you know, grew up with years ago, and I'm friend with him on Facebook. He was the biggest Celtics fan when we were growing up. And now he loves the Heat. Now, you know, he's lived in Florida for most of his life now. So, but I said, what happened? You used to be the biggest Celtics fan. Well, you know, I live down here. It's easier to follow. And now he's a big Heat fan. So I think you see a lot of that. I think basketball, if you had to ask anybody, there's a lot of people I know that their original basketball team that they liked is not the one that they like now.
Yeah, but for fans to do that, you know, in general, like as a hobby, that's okay. It doesn't bother me if you like, okay, I don't really care for this team anymore because I don't like this guy or I don't like the way they play or I don't like the organization's run, and I'm going to like this team. That's fine. Now, if you pay a ticket to go to the NBA Finals, which I know thousands of people behind you would be killing to go to, and you walk out early, that's shameful. And I think they should bolt their asses to that seat until the game is over. And I don't care if they win by 20 or they lose by 20. Because that's too prestigious of an event to just, okay, I'm done. I don't want to watch this anymore. Because I know there's a lot of fans that would kill to have that seat. You know, that's the only part that bothered me. But like Dr. G was saying, it's about your environment and it's about your resources. Like everybody, a lot of people I think were Braves fans just because, especially wrestling fans, because they watched TBS and the Braves were on TBS. I watched a lot of WGN because it was a superstation and I watched it a lot. I watched a lot of the Cubs. I watched a lot of the Bulls. So even though Michael Jordan was the most popular athlete on planet Earth, I still liked the Bulls because I got to watch them every night. Right. I didn't get to watch any of the other teams.
Yeah.
It is much easier when you're able to to root for a team. That's why, you know, for Scott, he's a Cowboys fan and a Lakers fan. I guess, you know, those are two teams that will be on a lot nationally, obviously. But, you know, I don't know. I found it very hard when I came back to live up here to be a Heat fan anymore because the Heat at that time when I came up here, again, they were still not that great.
Yeah.
And not even good. Never mind great. They weren't even good. And it was hard. So you never saw them on national television. It was very hard to follow. And I get a lot of flack for this, but I became a Nets fan because I'm a Yankees fan. And with the YES Network, the YES Network would carry the Nets. And I just happened to start rooting for them, obviously, when they got Jason Kidd and they went to the finals 2 years in a row. So if you want to call me a bandwagon
fan, also,
whatever.
You're also a closet Iron Eagle.
Is anybody a closet Iron Eagle fan? Yes. The reason I watch the Nets is Jim Spanarkle. So, yeah. No.
All right. But that's basically what happened for me. And obviously, I'm originally from Brooklyn. So now with the Brooklyn Nets, it's awesome. But, you know, I stayed with the Nets, though, even when after Kidd left and they were horrible. I still kind of stuck with them. And then when they said they were moving to Brooklyn – You know, so that for me, now it's easy. It's easy for me to follow. I can watch the games, but it's very hard if you're rooting for a team and you can't really watch. You know, there's no one to watch. Like you said, you became, you know, you watched the Bulls because you were able to watch them all the time on WGN.
Yeah. So Risha, for some reason, just pulled a U and somehow vanished. But it happens. It happens on Main Event all the time. In fact, the rest of the other guys don't want me to call them back. But yeah,
we
got
to get into the draft. I know we got a little off topic.
Yeah, but that's all right. We'll get to the draft in a minute.
That's
he's
how
gonna
we roll here.
Yeah, no, but he'll bounce back in a minute. We'll talk quickly about the reason. Well, also when I started, you know, when I became an NBA basketball fan was 1982. I was 9 years old, and I loved, you know, when you're a kid, you like colors. Colors are your big thing. And I liked purple. I thought purple and gold was a neat combo, and I loved Magic. So,
are you a girl?
He was my first. It was purple. It wasn't pink. It's not like I was rooting for, you know.
I pick things by colors.
Well, when you're 9 years old, what do you do? You know, I think that guy has a great. Nobody at 9 years old says, wow, I think they have a great jump shot. I mean, you know. But, yeah, that was. But I liked, you know, and I. But it was more because I liked Magic. And the Knicks were terrible. Here's the problem: when I, you know, a lot of the local teams in the early '80s were pretty crappy. So, you know, it was tough to be try and get him back on. It was tough to be a fan of other teams, particularly a Laker fan around here. All right, did what happened? Did Ray Allen pull the plug on your phone, or so?
I have no idea what happened.
All right,
I think I was talking about I don't even remember. I think I was talking about TBS, and I think Ted Turner pulled the plug.
Ted Turner pulled the plug because you were part of you and the Briscoes sold Georgia Championship Wrestling. That was your problem.
No, it was Bill Bush. Bill Bush canceled me.
Bill Bush. All right, let's we'll talk about Melo another time because that just happened, and we'll wait till that marinates
to tell
a little bit.
Yeah, in 2 weeks, I think we're gonna have a way more definitive answer. There's just way more. There's way too much this and that, and it might be the Bulls, it might be the Rockets, it might be the Heat. It's just there's just too much innuendo. We're gonna really know in about 2 weeks.
Okay,
I agree.
All right,
and then this shit hits the fan.
Yeah, let's dive into the draft. Obviously, the first real big thing that came out of the draft was about Joel Embiid from Kansas and his foot surgery. He was supposed to go number one to
Cleveland.
To Cleveland. A couple of people, particularly Gary Parrish and CBSSports.com, some other guys have him now going fourth to Orlando. Where do you think he's going to go now?
Man, I don't even know if he was going to – I'm being serious. I know that people said he was undisputed by the time they got to the workout phase where he impressed a lot of guys before he broke his foot. I don't even know if he was going to be number one because at the end, all these centers with these injury issues, I don't know if people at the very end of the day, once you get to draft day, you know, I've seen these big men get passed on, especially with a lot of these players these days where small forwards and point guards are like, you know, the birds and the bees. They're the ones that everybody wants. So everybody is saying that Joel Embiid was definitely going to be number one. It was unquestioned. Well, this is the same team that took Anthony Bennett when everybody thought they were going to take Nerlens Noel. So I don't think that was exactly a safe bet that Embiid was going to go number one. I'm not saying Embiid was going to be a bust because I don't think he's going to be a bust. I think he's still a very nice player who just has injury issues. But I think he's going to go fifth. I think he's going to tumble out of the top three because Philadelphia is just not going to take a chance on another big man with who they have to shut down for an entire year like they did with Noel. And I don't think the Magic are going to take them because I think they want to pick Dante Exum, you know, which is a point guard out of Australia. And I think the Jazz will take a chance on him because I don't think he's going to go past five. And if he does go past five, the Boston Celtics are going to absolutely snag him at number six.
I think the Sixers are going to take him.
Yeah. That's a very good chance that the Sixers are just going to say, fuck it, we still got Embiid right there at our lap. Why don't we just take him, you know, and maybe trade him for value if somebody's desperate enough to keep him. You know, the problem is with picking Embiid, you're probably going to get a really, really good, legit center, but you got to wait 6 months before he's even ready to step on a court, let alone get ready and get practice and all that stuff. So that was such a crazy turnabout of events, because I've never seen a scenario where a top player suffered an injury so devastating right before the draft that it's gonna that it takes him from a unanimous number one to all the way down to like the fifth pick or the sixth pick. Because Greg Oden had his microfracture surgery after he was picked number one.
Yeah.
When Bias died, that's different. You know,
right.
For Joel Embiid to just all of a sudden have this catastrophic injury a week before the draft is unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, that's kinda, that's pretty tough.
It is.
Kind of stinks for him.
He's a terrific player, man. He looks like Hakeem Olajuwon. He almost plays like him, only he's a little slower footed. But he's got great footwork. He's a great shot blocker. He moves well despite the foot problems. But yeah, once you're a big man, everybody can tell you this. Once you're a big man and you got the injury bug hovering over your head, it never goes away. It's something that will always follow you.
Yeah.
Do you see a scenario of him even falling out of the top five?
Yes. But if he does, he won't last long because the Celtics will take him. You know, I think the Celtics want to take either a point guard or a big man. And there's a lot of other big guys after Embiid, like Julius Randle, Aaron Gordon, Noah Vonleh, who I think is going to go higher now thanks to Embiid's injury. But
I think the Celtics are going to take Randle.
I love Randle, and that's the pick I have too. So, you know, they got a lot. And he's another guy who suffered a broken foot when he was in high school, and he's been playing with it without being properly repaired for pretty much his whole freshman year at Kentucky. But I love him. He reminds me of Zach Randolph, only more athletic.
Mm.
He's really, really nice player. But if MB goes all the way to six, Danny Ainge will take him in a heartbeat.
Now, with Embiid hurt and definitely not number one, in terms of number one, in terms of Cleveland and obviously Milwaukee at two, you've got two guys who are almost identical players, Jabari Parker and Andrew Wiggins. Both fours, threes.
Threes.
Good shooters. Both, I don't say they have heart issues, and not heart medical, heart aesthetic.
Determination.
Yeah. A lot of people thought Jabari Parker mailed it in when Duke lost to Mercer in the tournament. And Andrew Wiggins had a good year for Kansas. Kansas just had other struggles. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Embiid was hurt throughout a bit, and he got hurt in the tournament, too. Who do you see in that order? If they were 1-2, which is possible, I like them going 1-2. Who would the Cavs take, and who would the Bucks take?
I think the Cavs are going to take Wiggins because the athleticism alone for Andrew Wiggins is so impossible to ignore that – I'm not saying he's a can't miss because he has jump shot issues. He floats around at times because he's kind of a tweener. People think he's going to be a shooting guard instead of a small forward,
right,
even though he's 6'9", which is amazing. A 6'9" shooting guard, that dude would be a killer if he could make a jump shot. But he doesn't make a jump shot right now, and he disappeared a little bit down the stretch in the postseason. He would have games where he would just not do much, and then he would have a game where he would just be this amazing player, and he would score like 30 points or 25 points and get 9 rebounds. And you were like, oh, yeah, this is the guy I thought he was going to be. But, you know, I remember seeing that Instagram of him doing that max vertical. It was like 44 inches. It was just – I'm not saying that combines are like the end-all be-all of what makes a good player great and what makes a bad player awful. But when you see a guy like that jump out of the gym – in a controlled environment where trainers can get their hands on him in the NBA and really fine-tune their game, whether it be shooting, agility, defense, I think Wiggins is the total package in terms of athleticism. Mm. He could be a defensive stalwart. He could be one of those guys that just shuts down the star player, kind of like Tayshaun Prince used to when he was in Detroit. You know, I think he could be almost in the vein of LeBron James as an attacker if he really grows as with the mindset of going to the rim and getting his buckets. You know, I think he's got a lot of potential. Jabari Parker, he's not as tall, but he's more muscular. He's a hard worker, even though he did slouch a little bit at Duke. But the thing that makes Parker interesting is that he can go inside and bully little guys at the small forward spot. And he is a true small forward. I don't think he's a power forward. So I think he's going to be able to overpower guys at his spot almost in the same way LeBron does and get his shot off at any time he wants. But I think Cleveland taking Wiggins with Kyrie Irving, you know, feeding it to Wiggins on the wing is beautiful. I think that's going to work out really well for him, even though they got to wait a couple more years. Whereas Parker, I could see him being a 20-point-per-game scorer within a year in Milwaukee, you know, especially Milwaukee where they have no scoring whatsoever. They have no stars. So I think it's ideal either way, but I think the Cavs are going to go with Wiggins and the Bucks are going to go with Parker.
Okay. Nice tease that we all gave you. We are out of time for this segment. It'll come up sometime in the next couple days. Check out PlaysTeamNation.com for the Bible. And it is your Bible. Follow it. Don't worry about these guys on CBS Sports or ESPN or those other knuckleheads.
I will say this. That first round coming up, it's one of the best first rounds in about 6 or 7 years. This is a really, really loaded NBA draft.
Now, last thing I'll say before the end of the segment, and then you have to stop reading. But with the 7th pick, here's my prediction, Grish. The Lakers will take Marcus Smart.
That's exactly what I have.
I think they're going to take. They need the point guard. And as much as he's a freaking weirdo, the Lakers like those kind of guys. So,
yeah.
So, all right, Reesh, pleasure as always, my friend. We'll have you back on. We'll have you back on next show. We'll talk post-draft and some other stuff as well. And I will talk to you later this week so you can pick Alberto Del Rio to win the Money in the Bank.
Oh, no. It's going to be Lashley. We all know that.
Oh my gosh.
Eric Young's going to run in because now he needs a job. So, no. I will talk to you later this week on Police TV Nation's main event. When we come back, the Doctor and I will be joined by Joel Barnhart. We'll talk about Tony Gwynn and some other baseball news and notes. Stay with us. Extra Point returns after this.
What's going on? This is the Godfather, Nate Milton, with an offer you cannot refuse. Each and every week you can join Marcus Vandenberg, Big Nasty Alfred Kunawa, and myself on the Kings of Sport podcast, available exclusively on PlaceToBeNation.com, your one-stop spot for the best in sports and pop culture.
Hey, this is Ben Morse from Marvel.com as well as the Brad and Chad Show, and I've got a new podcast. Well, I'm part of a new podcast, Place to Be Nation's Main Event. Hosted by Scott Criscolo every other week, it's a roundtable discussion with myself, Andrew Reich, Steve Willey, Jordan Duncan, and an assortment of special guests as we talk wrestling today, the big questions, and our feelings. Please, please, please check this podcast out, because if the ratings go down, I know I'm the first head on the chopping block for Justin Rosero. See you guys every other week on Place to Be Nation's Main Event.
In Rhode Island and looking for great food and a fun atmosphere, well, be sure to stop by Bonehead's Wing Bar, 131 Washington Street in West Warwick, with over 65 different wing sauces and dozens of sandwiches, burgers, and appetizers, and a fully stocked bar. Bonehead's has something for everyone. Bonehead's also shows every WWE and UFC pay-per-view, features live music, weekly trivia, and much, much more. So, be sure to stop in, tell Matt and the crew that Police Simulation sent you, and become a Bonehead today.
Welcome back, Place to Be Nation, to PTVN's Extra Point. I am Scott Criscolo, along with the Doctor, Giorgio Bellino. I'd like to thank Andrew Reich for joining us to talk a little draft, a little Spurs, a little everything else. But now we're going to go from the hardwood to the diamond. And we usually don't have this gentleman on back-to-back shows. I usually have to give him a breather, but not only is he an awesome analyst for us, but obviously a sad day in Major League Baseball this week with the death of Hall of Fame outfielder Tony Gwynn, and he did a piece on PlaysToBeNation.com pertaining to it. So, let me bring back the man, the Macho Man of the Midwest. I try and give everybody a nickname. I have Reesh as the Bengal of the Bayou. Maybe I'll call you the Macho Man of the Midwest, because that is your Skype picture. Mr. Joel Barnhart. Joel, thanks for being back.
Oh, hey, no problem, guys. How you guys doing?
Good.
Good.
Before we dive into baseball in general, we'll talk about goings-on in baseball, as we are officially into summer now. So now we're into the meat and potatoes of the season. Let's talk about the very obviously sad death of Tony Gwynn, who passed away back on, last Tuesday, I think, a week ago. He passed away from cancer, which he got back in, 2010, I think. He had, mouth cancer from, I guess, jaw, and he had, jaw surgeries, and he had issues. He had, cancer on a nerve, and it sounded very unpleasant. And then on Tuesday, he passed away at the age of 54, and you posted an excellent piece back on Wednesday, I think it was, or was it Thursday? No, it was Thursday. On Thursday, about Tony Gwynn. What was it about him, Joel, that made him such a universally loved player? There weren't many. He was kind of I don't want to say like Ric Flair, but he's like one of those guys who you never heard a bad thing about him from anybody in Major League Baseball.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's, to me, that is the biggest takeaway, was just, nobody could say a bad word about him, even if they wanted to. And I think it was just, just because of how genuine he was. He was very honest with people. He was very helpful, with players and with other people. He tried really hard to, I think if anybody went to him for hitting advice, he was more than willing to help. He never, would shy a person away from that. He just seemed really likable, and he never tried to be anything he wasn't. He never tried to be anything but a high average, high average hitter. He never tried to fake his way into anything else. So, and he would just seem like a really good person. It's a real shame that we lost him, way earlier than we should have. It really is.
Well, Joel, it's so hard, especially in the world of sports, to find many guys like him where you can't even say a bad word about him. And just also a guy who played 20 years with the same team, mm-hmm. which is also another amazing feat. And just to go about it so gracefully like he did. And like you said, he never tried to be something he wasn't. He stayed within the within his talents. And, he had some great talents. I mean, probably one of the greatest hitters of all time. And, always was a good teammate. Did perform, even when he was in the 98 World Series. I want to say he hit between 350 to between 350 and 400, I believe, for the series. So I mean, he always, so it wasn't that he wasn't a clutch guy. It's just, obviously it takes 25 guys to win it. And I as a baseball fan, I have nothing negative to say. I think he was just a thrill to watch. Anytime you'd watch him, he was just magical with that bat. Just the way he was, it don't matter. He at least got one hit. It just seemed like it was very rare you saw him going 0-for-4.
Yeah, when I was researching that piece, I think I saw that he only went 0-for-4 just a couple times in his career. And yeah, in that 98 series, George, I've got it right here. He hit 500 with a home run and 3 RBIs. He was definitely a guy who just could always hit. He was maybe, between him and Wade Boggs, I think they might have been the best two pure hitters, of the last, 50, 60 years, just in terms of really putting the bat on the ball, making contact, and and really making every at bat something, you know, to watch.
And I remember I like the comparisons you made, Joel, in your piece when in 1997 when Ted Williams and Tony Gwynn sat and talked about hitting. I mean, who'd want to be a fly on the wall in that room? You know.
Oh, I
know.
I spent almost as much time writing the piece as I did looking for more of that conversation. I could only find a 3-minute clip, and I must have spent 2, 3, 4 hours over the course of this week just trying to find the full thing, because I know I've seen it somewhere. It's remarkable. They both seemed to just, you know, you couldn't find two more different human beings who just came together so well over one thing the way they did over hitting, it seemed.
Hmm. And here was a guy who didn't hit the ball out a lot. He was, you know, 135 home runs in 20 years, 17 homers in 1997. But that wasn't his role. I mean, the Padres through all those years had other guys meant to do that. Like the year they went to the World Series in 1984, you had Greg Nettles was a power guy on that team. And then throughout the 90s, you had, you know, guys like Greg Vaughn and Fred McGriff, and you had your mashers. Tony Gwynn's job was not to mash. His job was to get on base. And I think the best stat of all, and then Dr. G, you can chime in. One of the best stats I ever saw, and I can't remember who brought it up. I can't remember who it was. It might have been Chad Campbell. I think it was. Might have been even you, Joel. Now I can't remember. In 107 lifetime meetings with Greg Maddux, who, let's be honest, guys, is going to Cooperstown in a couple months, and or less than a month, and easily, you know, one of the, if not the best right-handed pitcher of our generation that didn't cheat. He struck out zero times.
Amazing.
And had a batting average of, I think, 315 or 415? No, maybe it was 315.
.415. I've got it right in front
of me. .415 batting average, and did not strike out against Greg Maddux.
That's
unheard of.
That is just that was one of the stats that was mind blowing, and I know I saw that stat a lot of places, and I think what I put in my piece was I took his plate appearances against Maddux, Pedro Martinez, and Curt Schilling, and against all of those guys he had like 400, I can't remember the exact number, but 400 plus plate appearances. And he struck out twice, and that was two times against Schilling. And, I mean, that's just...
Yeah.
That's remarkable, because, I mean, Greg Maddux wasn't a high strikeout guy, but he was Greg Maddux. He was great. Curt Schilling and Pedro, I mean, in the 90s, those guys were strikeout machines. So,
yep.
He was just so remarkable, and... Yeah, and to do it with his you know, body type is even probably more of a testament to just how good he was at it, because, you know, it's easy to just look at him and say, you know, well, who could look at that guy and think he'd be a great hitter, but he was just so dedicated to being that type of guy that, you know, he was just—you couldn't get him out.
He looked like one of those guys you'd see on your local softball team, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
You didn't think of him as being like, you know, this first-class athlete. You know, it is amazing. I mean, I would definitely put him. If I would say, I think he's even better than Wade Boggs as a hitter.
Yeah, he probably is. Wade Boggs is probably a contemporary, but yeah, I would probably put Gwynn ahead of him if I'm ranking them, and, you know, subjectively.
I mean, I wouldn't say he's by far better, but
no, but I would, you know, if I'm making a list, he's definitely up there. I think Suzuki is a good comp too. Although Suzuki had a totally different toolbox than Gwynn did,
right?
You know, But yeah, it's just, I mean, I remember in 94 and you know, I was just really starting to get into baseball, which I've always felt ironic that I got into baseball the same year so many people said, that's it, I'm done.
Yeah. 1994 is kind of one of those years that people admit didn't happen, but.
Yeah, but I just remember the hysteria of, you know, and to me, I was like, wait, who is this guy? You know, because he played, I was living on the East Coast, he's out on the West Coast, and I'm just like, who the heck is this guy? And then I read, you know, about Ted Williams, and I'm like, well, okay, I know that name. That's and to have those two names together, even though I was just learning about the game of baseball at a later age. I mean, mm-hmm. I was 14, and I was just really getting into it. I knew that name, Ted Williams, and I knew if those two names are in the same sentence, that means something. And you know, he was. Williams was great in his own way, but yeah, just, you know, and Gwen just, he just was such a good person, too, and I think that's really, that may stand out just as much as his ability to hit the ball, is just
how
likable he was.
Mm. And, I mean, there's not that many guys that you could say that about in baseball, but he's definitely one of them.
Mm. I think the other great stat, talk about bat control that you have on your piece, Joel. And I don't want to read the whole thing. I want everyone to go to placetobenation.com and check it out. It's a fantastic piece that Joel did. Right now, okay, Ryan Howard leads the majors in strikeouts with 89 strikeouts he has, and he struck out 36 times in May alone. Tony Gwynn's season high for strikeouts in a season, 40.
Wow.
40. 400 in 20 years, he struck out 434 times. Mm-hmm. That's ungodly. And in an era where right-handed pitchers and left, I mean, pitching in the 90s, I mean, let's go back to the 80s. You know, he was facing guys like, I'm thinking a National League pitcher. Well, he faced one of my guys of all time, Doc Gooden, in his prime. Mm-hmm. God, who else? Steve Carlton. And then you go to the 90s, as you would think your career would erode a bit. And he's facing, again, like you said, Joel, Curt Schilling, Pedro, Randy Johnson. I mean, he was facing the unit a lot. Remember, he was in the AL West for a few years. Mm-hmm. So he was facing the Padres and Diamondbacks obviously face each other 17 times, 18 times a year. His stuff did not erode.
No. Yeah,
his gut got a little bigger, but...
Yeah, yeah, I mean...
You know, whatever. I mean, I wish I could... I'm just the fat half. I'm not the fat and good hitter half. I wish I had both. I got the wrong end.
Same here. Yeah, he won four of his 8 batting titles. He won 94, 95, 96, 97. He hit 354, 368, 353... and then 372 to cap it off, and that's a 4-year average. You know, let me see if I can find it here. Yeah, that's a 4-year average of 371.
In one year, he was close to 400.
Yeah. I mean, that's his age 34, 35, 36, 37.
Yeah. Years where guys' bat speeds go down.
Exactly.
It's crazy.
And his never seemed to, but...
Nope.
He's just an amazing ball player, and just to know that we were lucky to be able to see him in our generation to watch him play. And you know, it was, you know, when every time I would always go check the, you know, the paper for the average leaders and all that. I mean, you'd be shocked when you didn't see Gwynn at the top in the National League. I think it was more shocking not to see him there than to see him there. I mean, he was just unbelievable. And like I said, just a good person as well. And, you know, the baseball world is, you know, is very sad because it's a sad day, sad time because, you know, one of its good guys is no longer with us.
Yeah, it's always a shame when any anybody goes, but especially when they're such a beloved person, and you know, and it's just unfortunate that you know, and I mean, you know, cancer can take anybody. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, my dad had his own fight with it, and he's still around, thank God. But it's a scary thing, and you know, it's really too bad. And you know, I've been hearing and seeing people who say, well, we don't know that smokeless tobacco caused Tony Gwynn's cancer. That's stupid. And I'm just like, well, it didn't help him.
Right.
I mean, what's your argument there if you're saying smokeless tobacco didn't cause his cancer? You know, I mean, why are you making that argument? What kind of out are you looking for?
Right.
It doesn't make sense to me, but it's just really, it's a shame that people are, that there are a few people out there who are trying to turn this into some kind of agenda, because it shouldn't be an agenda. It should be a celebration.
I agree. I agree wholeheartedly on that. And yeah, that's the way the world is today. You know, it's, you know, especially with all the social media and everything, somebody's got to, you know, get on their high horse about something. It's, you know, we should be celebrating, you know, a legend of the sport. I mean, you know, again, he played in San Diego. Maybe, you know, he's not in the gigantic media market, you know, like here in the Northeast or you know, even your city, Detroit, you know, but he still did a great job. And you know, I think he was a great ambassador.
Is he there?
I don't have him.
He's probably floating around. Maybe he hit mute. But yeah. Well, let me finish his thought. He was a great ambassador, and he'll be very sorely missed. There's no doubt about that. All right. Yeah. Let's get into a little bit of some you know, current stuff as we head into summer. Are you there, Doctor?
Yep, I'm here. For some reason, we got disconnected.
Yeah, no problem. I was finishing your point about him being a great ambassador, but go ahead, finish your point.
Right. No, my point I was making is, Joel, and I don't know if you agree with me because you cover baseball. I don't think Major League Baseball does a great job of promoting their good guys of the game. I even though, you know, a lot of people say, you know, Derek Jeter has been the face of baseball, but I never felt like they promoted him the way they could have. Especially through all this era of steroids and the stuff they went through, and you know, here was a guy that's clean and was a good guy, has a great image. You know, I just never felt like they did that. I you know, Tony Gwynn could have been promoted better than he was.
No, you're absolutely right. They don't do a good job of promoting it, and I think the reason for that, George, it's a business first and foremost, and you know. A good life makes a boring biography, and a good, well-behaved, rule-abiding ball player doesn't sell merchandise, doesn't move the needle. And unfortunately, when it comes to business and PR, a guy like Tony Gwynn, as sad as it is, you know, they don't promote him because, you know, the only people that are going to buy a Tony Gwynn jersey are Padres fans. You know, it's a shame. And I think you're right. I think that, you know, we need more good players promoted. I mean, I think we're on the right track with guys like Harper and Trout. They really, I mean, Harper's competitive, but he doesn't seem like a bad person. You know, Trout seems like a really, you know, good individual. You know, but yeah, I completely agree with that point.
Yeah, I baseball is my first and foremost favorite sport, and I love football. Don't get me wrong, I love, you know, I'm a Giants fan. But there's just something about baseball. You know, it's always been a big part of my life. It's something that I share with my good friends, my family. And I just get so upset that the sport's not promoted well enough. I get it that baseball's a little bit more regionalized than it is, you know, like the NFL, where you know you have Giants fans everywhere, or you have Pittsburgh Steelers fans in different places. But right. when you have somebody at the magnitude or such a great player like a Tony Gwynn, or you know, a Derek Jeter, or Mike Trout, and all those guys, you really those are the faces. That's who you want to be representing your sport. Right. And it's just I get it. I agree with you the whole thing with the marketing and all that, but in terms of for your sport, but if you did promote them properly, maybe you would see more Tony Gwynn jerseys being worn, because the kids today love who the popular player are. They'll wear, don't matter what team they're a fan of, they're gonna, you know, they'll go out and buy you'll see LeBron James jerseys everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, right. It's just I get very disappointed about it, but I guess there's it's just the way it's done. I mean, obviously baseball is making money, so they're doing something right. But I think they could even be more popular if they really, you know, put the marketing behind those guys.
Right. I think the other thing that needs to be mentioned here when you're talking about role models and marketing, here's Tony Gwynn, who, and we talked about the, you know, he had a little pot belly, but there's a guy who was putting up great numbers in an era where everybody else's numbers are suspicious, if you catch my drift.
Yeah.
You'll never see Tony Gwynn on a Mitchell report, that's for sure.
That's very true. I mean, yeah. He, you know, he would never be mistaken. I mean, you know, and I don't remember if I put this in the piece I wrote or not, but, you know, one of the things Ted Williams told him is he said, you know, you're a big guy. You need to hit for more power. And, you know, Tony Gwynn kind of took that to heart. You know, the next year after that quote came out, he popped, you know, 12 home runs and then 17 and 16. And, you know, so he, you know, but in the end, he just, I think he knew, you know, I'm never going to do better than, you know, than a dozen. So, you know, but yeah, he was kind of the anti Mitchell report type player. And yeah, I think baseball needs more guys, you know, that kind of follow that Tony Gwynn mold. And I do think they're on the right track. I mean, Mike Trout's been popping up, you know, in all kinds of national ads and you know, he's a very popular player. But yeah, I just, you know, it's like I said, occasionally those bad apples, you know, do get the higher amount of press and coverage.
Yep.
And yeah, you know, that's just the way it is. 'Cause as a reporter, I can tell you, you love to talk to the good guys, but you do sometimes have to write about the bad guys because there's just a better story there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So check out Joel's piece on Tony Gwynn on PlaceToBeNation.com. Incidentally, Dr. G, before we get in a few minutes to talk a little baseball in general, little trivia for you, sir. Tony Gwynn, don't say anything, Joel, because you have it on your article. Tony Gwynn was the 58th overall pick in the second round by the Padres in the 1981 draft. Do you know the Yankees drafted six spots before Tony Gwynn?
No, I didn't know that.
George, you don't read my stuff?
I didn't want him to. I didn't want him to cheat. I wanted him to try and guess this question.
Well, if he's under orders, then all is forgiven.
He is under orders, but he will read your piece, believe me.
Yes.
He will.
I love you.
Do you remember who the Yankees drafted six spots before the Padres drafted Tony Gwynn?
I can't. It's not Fred McGriff, is it?
Nope. John Elway.
Oh, right.
That's another. The 83 NFL draft is another discussion for another day. By the way, it's a great 30 for 30.
Wow.
Joel, we got. Oh, go ahead.
See where that went.
Yeah. Well, he was going to play for the Yankees. You got to watch the 30 for 30 from Elway to Marino on ESPN. It's on YouTube or whatever. You were going to have him. Steinbrenner had him all set. He played a year in Oneonta. He was going to be a Yankee if the Colts didn't do anything about it. Trust me, he would have. And apparently, he was a left-handed pull hitter who would have played. I think he would have played third.
Man, could you imagine if he actually?
I know, isn't that wild? If he was going to stay a Colt and never get traded to Denver, he would have been a Yankee. But in any event, well, we have a few minutes left, Joel. Let's bounce around some stories from around the league. I find it unfathomable that the Mets are 6 games under 500. They're only 5 games out of first place, but that's just a mess of a whole other stinky pile. Let's talk about the team that's nipping at your heels in the AL Central, and that's the I almost called them the Chiefs. The Kansas City Royals, who went on that incredible winning streak, and then they, you know, it got broken, but they're only 2.5 games behind your Tigers, whose bullpen sucks. What do you think it is with the Royals? Where did this come from?
Honestly, fluke. And I'm not saying that as a Tigers fan. I look at that team, and there's talent. I mean, they've got a heck of a bullpen still, but I just don't see this is a team that's going to keep that going. I think they're too inconsistent with their power. Mm-hmm. It comes and goes. The starting pitching comes and goes. So they're a decent team, but unless they add like a really consistent deadline hitter or two or another arm behind Shields in that rotation, yeah, it was a cool run, and it was fun to kind of follow it. You know, even again as a Tigers fan, I thought, hey, good for them, but it was a fluke. I mean, this is a team that last played in the playoffs when Reagan was in office, so you know, I just
long time ago.
That's for sure.
Yikes. And they've dropped 4 straight, so you know, so it's you know, it's just an up and down team.
Do you see the Tigers doing anything for that bullpen? I mean, I would say their main weakness right now.
If they don't, I'll probably get arrested. they need something. I mean,
but there's a lot of teams that need something, so it's going to be tough. Do they have the chips?
That's true. Well, you know, Dave Dombrowski, the Tigers GM, is very good at trading pieces, and he tends to trade the right pieces. He doesn't trade guys that come back to haunt him very often.
Right.
I mean, you look at that Cabrera trade back in the winter of, I think it was 07. I mean, he traded 6 players, including 2 number 1 draft picks, and none of them have had anything close to a sustained successful run. I mean, 2 of them are relievers, and Cameron Maben is a so-so center fielder. So, yeah, I think the Tigers, I think they have to address that bullpen. I think that's probably the only thing they'll do. But to just bring it back around to the Royals, I could see them doing something. They've got a lot of great pieces in their system.
Yes, they do.
If they could somehow land a Jeff Samardzija or David Price, that would make them very formidable, but I don't see it happening. This is a, you know, just a hot streak in the middle of the season.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think I tend to agree with you there. I don't think the Royals, I don't think they have what it takes to overcome the Tigers. The only thing I could see hurting the Tigers, like I said, is if they don't get some bullpen help. But otherwise, I think the starting pitching and the hitting is there. I think they're fine there. I just think, you know, but the bullpens have become a very big part of the baseball landscape. If you don't have a good bullpen, you're in a lot of trouble. Because you need somebody to close out the games.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I mean, I could go on for hours about my theories and feelings about bullpen management, but yeah, you still need one.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, we've become so reliant on it. I mean, it's very rare you see starting pitchers. You know, it's like get them out of there after 6 or 7 innings and get to the bullpen. And these days, some teams look for 6 innings. That's it, and we'll take the rest. Take care of the rest with the bullpen.
Mm. Yeah. And our two divisions, Joel, the National League East and the American League Central, the only two that still has a lot of parity. I mean, in terms of up and down, I mean, the last place Phillies are only 5 out. The last place White Sox are only 7 out. The rest of the divisions, I mean, the last place teams are in trouble. The Rays are 11 back of the Blue Jays.
Yeah.
The Cubs, well, we won't talk about them. And the Astros and Diamondbacks are just the shits compared to these. We talked about Oakland the last time you were on. Maybe next time you're on, we'll delve more into the A's, who continue to just win. Best record in baseball as of right now at 47-28.
Yeah,
Joel, it has been a pleasure. Once again, check his piece out about Tony Gwynn on PlaceToBeNation.com. He also will, I'm sure your next power rankings will be coming out, we usually do them monthly, so next week or so, probably.
Yeah, we'll probably work on them, 27th, 28th, 29th. They'll be out around the first of the month.
Yeah, so another week and a half, you'll check out his June power rankings.
Yep, and I've got a few other things in the works, a couple player profiles and a couple other things that, if the real world lets me, I'm hoping to get those out before July 4th.
So. Maybe a nice Hall of Fame piece you could throw up there summertime, perhaps?
Yeah, I'm kind of kicking that around. Probably.
Little Greg Maddux. Who the hell's in the Hall this year? Greg Maddux.
Maddux, Glavin, and I believe Frank Thomas.
I got to do something with the Big Hurt.
Yeah.
He was a fantasy, not that we do it, and we do it for free and just for fun, but he was a fantasy machine for me in the 90s.
Yeah,
he was a stat monster. I love the Big Hurt.
Yeah, I lived in Georgia during their prime, and so, as you can imagine, first pick Greg Maddux, second pick Tom Glavin, and Maddux and Glavin were always top guys, and Thomas would go pretty early because he was so good, and all three of them just very deserving, absolute studs. So. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'll have to mark that on my calendar and crank something out for them too, because
it's a Braves Hall of Fame this year, because Bobby Cox, Joe Torre, and La Russa are going in.
That's right.
As managers, so it's a nice class this year.
Mm. That's one of the best classes I can remember in history. Yeah. That's loaded.
I think easily. I mean, that '99 class that had Robin Yount, Nolan Ryan, and.
Was it Brett?
George Brett. I mean, that was ridiculous. but now you're going to see classes like that, because a lot of these guys all retired. Like next year, you know who's first ballot next year is Randy Johnson and Pedro.
Mm-hmm.
Those are guys you can't ignore by any stretch of the imagination. So
no, and I just want to see them standing next to each other. That's going to be amazing. And
it's kind of like it's like the great Khali and Ranjan Singh, or Hornswoggle,
Yeah.
Joel, pleasure as always.
Absolutely.
When we come back, before we wrap it up, the Cowboy with his MMA Blitz. That's up next. Place TV Nation's Extra Point.
What's up, wrestling fans? This is Jeff Peck, and you can check out my wrestling podcast, The Still Real To Us Show, every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com. It is a wrestling podcast from a fan's perspective, and we're not doing it in our mom's basement. So check it out every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
Looking for new wrestling, sports, and pop culture voices? Head over to PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We have an extremely talented staff that covers comics, video games, and all facets of entertainment. Our sports coverage spans all the major professional and collegiate sports, including MMA. Our fresh takes on professional wrestling are some of the best on the internet. Don't forget to check out our fantastic podcasts as well, including the voice of Ring of Honor, Kevin Kelly, exclusively at PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Also, be sure to check out our friends at thehistoryofwwe.com, prowrestlingonly.com, Scott Keith blog at rspwfaq.net, and PileDriverWrestling.net.
Closing time. Open all the doors and let you out into the world.
All right, here is segment four, segment three, two. Welcome back to PTBN's Extra Point. I'm Scott Griscola. I'd like to thank Joel Barnhart for joining us to talk a little Tony Gwynn. Rest in peace, one of the greatest hitters in the history of the game, dead at the age of 54. Very sad. One guy who never makes me sad is here to wrap the show up, The Blitz. Of course, you can also hear him on our sister show down the hall, the Sports Lounge, where he goes in-depth with his MMA with Chad Campbell. And they had a great show this past week, talking about the World Cup and the draft and some other fun things. But he's always nice to be back with us to do his MMA Blitz. And fresh home from Riverside. For those of you that don't live in anywhere near the Northeast, you have no idea what I'm talking about. But I will let him expound on that. The cowboy himself, Roger Morissette. Raj, thank you for being with us as always.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Tell everybody what Riverside used to be and why I, as an old school New Englander, am very close to my heart, even though it's not called that anymore. Let everyone know.
So spent yesterday up at Six Flags New England, formerly known as Riverside Park, up in Agawam, Massachusetts. And we attempted to do the MMA Blitz on the Mass Pike last night, but ran into some technical difficulties. So I'm here in the comfort of my own home right now. But yeah, Riverside Park, I actually remember going there as a child as well, and been a number of times since it's been Six Flags New England. So it's a good place. I chickened out and didn't go on their extremely tall swing. I waited in line for an hour and then wimped out right at the end. Mrs. Cowboy is not going to let me forget that one anytime soon. But overall, it was a good day.
That's good. No, it's good to have you back on solid ground, and it's good to have you here. So I'm going to step away. The Cowboy and the Blitz.
Excellent. So last Saturday, we had UFC 174, Demetrius Mighty Mouse Johnson versus Ali Bagatinov. Great card top to bottom. Looked like a great card top to bottom. At the end of the day, it ended out not being the most exciting card in the world, but I'll break it down for you. Mighty Mouse coming into this fight, a lot of pound for pound hype he's been receiving. He's been on a good run. Since flyweight champion, technically sound. One of the knocks against him was that, you know, like a lot of little guys, doesn't carry a lot of power. Well, in his previous fight before this fight, he knocked out Joseph Benavidez basically with one shot. So that really started the hype train rolling for Mighty Mouse. And Bagatinov, no slouch himself. He's been on a good run in the UFC, been walking through guys. So I thought that this was going to be a real competitive fight, kind of a speed of Johnson versus strength of in wrestling of Bagatinov. And Johnson really, really impressed me here. Impressed anyone who watched the fight. He just dominated all 25 minutes. Bagatinov didn't win a second of the fight. It was just thorough domination by Mighty Mouse. He was in and out. He hit hitting Bagatinov four or five times before Bagatinov could return fire. Mighty Mouse showed that the talk about him being probably the most technically proficient fighter in the world today is accurate. There's really no holes in his game, and he is just lightning fast. Did go the full five rounds, so I kind of thought that knockout against Benavidez was a bit of an aberration. Mighty Mouse is not a big power puncher or anything, but if you're someone who can appreciate the intricacies of the sport and appreciate kind of a Floyd Mayweather-esque type of MMA fighter, the hit and don't be hit. Mighty Mouse is your guy, and it's a climbing pound for pound list. He's pretty much in everybody's top five, if not top two or three right now. So, and then kind of important for the UFC too, in that we had a flyweight title fight headlining an actual pay-per-view card, not a fight night or a free one, but a pay-per-view card. And, I think that's good. These little guys provide a lot of action. If you're somewhat new to MMA or someone who hasn't watched a lot of MMA and maybe interested, I'd strongly suggest taking a look at the little guys. It's like taking taking your standard fight and just hitting the fast forward button. These guys are so fast. It's a lot of fun to watch. Also on the card, and you know, for me, probably the most important fight on the card. We had Rory McDonald versus Tyron Woodley in the welterweight division. The welterweight division is just stacked right now, and this is kind of a de facto tournament going on to set up the title fights for the future. So McDonald and Woodley had been on a real, real strong run since coming over from Strikeforce. Just real athletic, kind of a wrestler who uses his wrestling to keep the fight standing and just land haymakers. McDonald, who has just been an uber prospect, he's only 24 years old, already has a bunch of UFC fights, almost beat Carlos Condit a couple of years ago, lost in the last 7 seconds of the fight that he was winning. But he had stumbled a little bit with a loss to Robbie Lawler. He came back and beat Damian Maya, and I had said coming into the fight that I thought McDonald was just going to be too well-rounded for Woodley. And yeah, there was definitely some debate. I know Chad Campbell on our the sister show, that Sports Lounge, that Scott had mentioned, picked Tyron Woodley to win this fight. I felt McDonald would dominate, and McDonald did in fact dominate the fight, setting himself up for an eventual shot at the title. He should get the winner of Johnny Hendricks, who's the current champion, and Hendricks is going to be fighting the winner of Robbie Lawler and Matt the Immortal Brown. I think McDonald slides in to fight the winner of that, and I like McDonald against any one of those guys. I think he's the best welterweight in the world, and he really came to fight. He pressured the physical specimen Woodley. It looks like he's cut out of a block of granite, and he's just a real, real good athlete. And McDonald just made him fight backing up the whole fight and befuddled him, and it made him look very, very amateurish. So very, very good performance by Rory. And also on the card, we had Ryan Bader against Feijão Cavalcanti. Bader won easy. The one issue with the card was that there weren't a lot of competitive fights, so Bader won that one easily. Cavalcanti looked awful. Bader's in a weird position at light heavyweight in that he has like zero chance against the real class of the division, but if you're not in the top five, you're gonna have a big problem beating him. So he's in that kind of no man's land that Rich Franklin was in for a while at middleweight after Anderson Silva had beaten him a couple times. Well, we know you can't beat the champ. John Jones destroyed Bader a couple of years ago, and I can't imagine if they fought today the result would be any different. But you can't beat the champ, but no one can, not too many other guys can beat you. So it's kind of a weird place for a career to be, but it was fine. He won a decision. What interested me, a heavyweight fight on the card, was the return of Andrei Arlovsky, who back a while ago, back a few years, he was just a destroyer in the UFC. He was your UFC heavyweight champion and was legitimately the baddest man on the planet back in 05 and 06. And he took a couple of losses in the UFC, lost his title to Tim Sylvia in a huge upset in a real memorable bout where Arlovsky had Sylvia almost out, and Sylvia hit him with a home run punch, and that really kind of spelled the end of Arlovsky's title run. And he fought outside of the UFC for the last 8 years with very mixed success. His chin really has betrayed him. He's had a number of pretty scary knockout losses to the point where it's questionable. It's questionable whether he should even continue, because he was, for example, he fought Brett the Grim Rogers, not a very skilled guy in Strikeforce, and Rogers just knocked him out cold, and he had a couple of fights like that. And he fought Arlovsky fought Brendan Schaub, UFC veteran. I'm not a huge fan of Schaub's game. He's kind of a guy who, good athlete, good power, but the sum isn't quite as good as the individual parts. He's never really put it together. So and he's also a little chinny. He's been knocked out before too. So what we got was a very cautious stand-up fight from both guys. I thought Schaub did enough to win. They gave the decision to Arlovsky. I don't have a huge quarrel with it. It wasn't certainly wasn't a clear decision either way. And it was one of those fights where there really weren't any winners, and that it was pretty unexciting. And, you know, we're not going to be clamoring to see either one of these guys again. Although, you know, given the nostalgia factor with Arlovsky, it's good. In my mind, it's good that he won, and maybe he can parlay this into a meaningful fight, kind of a lifetime achievement award. So that wraps up UFC 174. Like I said, good card, really a card for the purists. And if you either like the way Mighty Mouse fights or you're bored by it, but you can't deny the guy's got all sorts of talent. This Saturday, the 28th, we have the second time the UFC's done this recently, where we have two UFC fight nights on the same night, one of them airing on TV and the other airing on the UFC app for the iPad. The main events there, we have Cub Swanson versus Jeremy Stevens. That's the one that's on TV. That's the one I would watch if I were you guys. Cub's always a fun, real fun fighter to watch, and Stevens brings it. On the app, we have James Tahuna versus Nate Marquardt. It's from New Zealand. That's what I can say about it. It's neither one of these are great cards, but if you got nothing going on and you like MMA, tune in. Especially, like I said, for the Cub Swanson Stevens fight. Cub's a lot of fun to watch, and so is Stevens. But what we're really, really excited for is July 5th. We have a middleweight title fight. Chris, the All-American Weidman, conqueror of Anderson Silva twice, versus Lyoto the Dragon Machida. And this is going to be one of the top two or three cards of the year. I haven't broken down this main event yet, but it's a real tough one to call. Weidman's 11-0. He's looked real good. He looked great against Silva in both fights, knocking him out in the first fight. And then second fight, he won the first round, and then Silva broke his shin in half, kicking Weidman in the leg, which was pretty nasty to see. But Machida just has that karate style where he can make guys look bad, and he's looked great since dropping from light heavyweight. So it's not often that we have a true toss-up fight for a major title, but I think that's what we have here. And, you know, I said this on the Sports Lounge, and I'll say it here. If you're an MMA person or kind of on the fence about it, buy this card or figure out a way to watch this card, and I think you're going to be hooked, because in the co-main event, Ronda Rousey's fighting, who everybody knows. She's fun to watch, and so, you know, she's added a lot to the UFC. And then in the on the televised undercard, you have two fights that I think are going to be a lot of fun to watch. Stefan Struve, who's a 7 foot tall heavyweight, against Matt Mitrione, the former football player. Both those guys like to stand and bang. And then the California kid Uriah Faber is fighting Alex Caceres, and Faber's always fun to watch. But that's going to be a fantastic card. And I'm not ready to make my call yet in the main event. I don't know yet. I go back and forth every day. I'm leaning Machida right now, but I'm not confident in it. But that's what we have going on in the world of MMA, and I'm sure I'll be back here on the Extra Point most likely after the middleweight title fight to break it down for you guys and see what happens. But until then, thanks, Scott, for having me, and thanks, listeners, for devoting 15 minutes of your life to the sport I love.
And then we'll hear more about it when I see you on Sunday sitting in the van. So.
Absolutely, I'll be driving the van. No choice but to listen to me ramble.
Yes. Roger, of course, the Cowboys joining the rest of us crew, myself, Mr. Rosero, and the gang for Money in the Bank this coming Sunday in Boston. So, Cowboy, pleasure as always. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us for this episode of PTBN's Extra Point. For the Doctor, Andrew Reich, Joel Barnhart, and the Cowboy, I'm Scott Criscolo. You've hit the Extra Point. Enjoy Money in the Bank. Enjoy the World Cup. Talk to you in a couple. And I'm a wanted and watching you walk away. Oh, I try to meet you by the old highway. Oh, and it is now I'm down to slack with the sun shone across my back. And I'm comforted to know that you're backstage at my show.
of your attention. Having this discussion downtown. Oh, no obligation. It's a real art of motion. Now that you're gone, moving right along inside. One down the road, still viewing sluts. About get this hose trying to fool me. No promises, you got that one time slam. Seductive, sexy givers in the Hilton tram with this abuse of napkins. X amount of Heineken. Waking up so hard to do when I'm lying next to you. So I'm knocking at your door. Complicates the night before. She says the joke is on me. I say the joke is on her. Mary, oh Mary, still so quite contrary. How could you ever know? And I'm a wanting to watching you walk away. Oh, I'll try to meet you by the old highway. Oh, and if it's now I'm down to slack with the sun shone across my back, and I'm comforted to know you're backstage at my show now. And I'm wow that you're going. And I'm a wanting to watch your game. And I'm a wanting to watch your game.